Anatomy and Physiology, the Urinary System, Part 1. Here is simply an overview figure from your book of some of the organs we'll be studying in this unit. But let's get right to it. Here's the basic gross anatomy of the urinary system. We have two kidneys, one on each side of the body, kind of shaped like kidney beans, aren't they? They are the workhorse of the system. Now, one semester in a face-to-face class, a student raised her hand. She said, "What does that mean, the workhorse of the system?" And I thought that was common knowledge, but I guess it's old-fashioned. It just means that the kidneys do most of the work in the urinary system. That's what it means, and we'll focus almost all our attention in this unit on the anatomy and physiology of the kidneys. The ureters come next. These are these tubular structures that come from the kidneys and transport the urine down to this muscular bag called the urinary bladder. The urinary bladder simply holds and releases the urine. And finally, on this figure, we have the urethra, which transports urine to the outside of the body. And in males, it also transports semen as well. I have a little memorization technique that I use here that helps me in lecture and in the lab. So maybe in your cats, this will help you. I just remember that the ureters are internal, and the urethra throws the urine out. And that helps me a little bit, so hopefully that mnemonic device will help you as well. But let's get down to the real important stuff. The next two slides really summarize the major functions of the kidney. When I do the next part of this discussion, we'll dive into the details of exactly how your kidneys do these things. But these two slides have all really the major bullet points you need to know, hopefully forever, of a really great summary of what the job your kidneys are. Let's start at the top. The kidneys have the function of filtering blood, plasma, and producing urine. I bet you knew that before you even came to class, so to speak. We'll talk about the details in the next part of this unit. One of the main things we're making urine for is to get rid of waste products from the body. And I want to spend a lot of time on this slide diving into some of the details. And you're going to need to make a lot of notes here because it's nowhere else to be found in the PowerPoints. I want you to know where each of these waste products is derived from. Let's start at the top. Ammonia is a waste product. It's a breakdown product from the metabolism of proteins. That's right. When your body breaks down and metabolizes proteins, it produces certain things. One of them is this waste product that we know as ammonia, which is toxic to the body. Ammonia actually comes from the amino group in proteins. You studied that earlier in your A&P career. Remember, the amino group had the N in it, had the nitrogen in it. That's an important point to know, and I'll get back to that shortly. Urea, you should write down, is also a breakdown product from the metabolism of proteins. Again, particularly from that amino group. Your liver actually metabolizes ammonia and detoxifies it to a less toxic form called urea. But both the ammonia and the urea are placed in the urine and excreted from the body. You'll hear the term nitrogenous waste products. Nitrogenous waste products are just the ones that have the nitrogen in them. They do include ammonia and urea. Creatinine and uric acid also have nitrogen in them, by the way. But I just don't want you to be freaked out when you get in the real world and someone says something on the kidney dialysis unit about the nitrogenous waste products. It just means the ones that have nitrogen in them. And ammonia and urea are two great examples. A couple of clinical things here to bring it down to earth. The ammonia and the urea that are in your urine kind of give the odor. We've all smelled the urine in the urinal, and those substances kind of give it that odor you're familiar with. Furthermore, you will see patients who are in renal failure. If your kidneys are failing, you can't put those waste products in the urine. They build up in the blood. They actually tend to come out in the sweat through those patients' pores. And if you've ever seen a patient in renal failure, and if you've gotten close enough to them to smell them, they have sort of the odor of urine through their skin. You're smelling the ammonia and the urea in their sweat. And I'll take it a step further. When that sweat dries out on their skin, it sort of crystallizes. There's actually a name for it. It's a cool thing to do an internet search on. It's called a urea frost. It almost looks like they have frost, like frost on a windshield, but they have frost on their skin, and it's from these waste products. This brings me to another clinical point. There are these diets out there. High protein diets, low carb diets, and I'm not disrespecting the diet. Please don't take it the wrong way. I know certain diets work well in certain patients, but it kind of freaked me out a little bit that there was this diet where you can eat all the protein you want. You could have like a side of beef, you could have a slab of ribs, you could have 3 packs of bacon, you could have the whole cow, you just can't put the bun around it, right? And it always kind of sat funny in my brain because I'm thinking, you know what? I know if I'm eating all that protein, the protein's going to get broken down in waste products like ammonia and urea, and those are going to be sent to the kidneys, right? And if I overstuff or overwork any organ in my body, what might eventually happen to that organ? And I'm thinking to myself, it might get damaged from being overworked. And sure enough, if you do an internet search on some of those high protein diets and then, you know, put in a kidney failure or kidney disease, you will get a number of hits on that. It was bound to happen. I knew it was going to happen. Let's move on to the next waste product in urine. It's called creatinine. You should write down that creatinine is a waste product from the breakdown of your old friend from muscle metabolism, creatine phosphate. That's right. That was that energy storage compound in muscles. If you remember muscle physiology, of course, ATP was the short-term energy money. But ATP only lasts about a minute, but your muscles have to work more than a minute in many cases. So if you recall, that phosphate, the high-energy phosphate, was sort of held onto by creatine phosphate. Well, when creatine phosphate from your muscles gets broken down, it turns into a waste product that we get rid of in the urine called creatinine. That reminds me of another thing. In college, I was a bodybuilder. And there was this creatine powder you could buy at the health food store. And you take a couple scoops of the powder, you mix it up with some milk, something like that, and you drink that. And the thought was, the person who knew a little bit about muscle physiology and a little bit about A&P said, hey, if creatine phosphate is the energy compound in muscles, if we take it in a powder, I get more energy, I could do more work, I could build bigger muscles. So that was the thinking behind it. But after learning about some of this stuff, I said to myself, now wait a minute, if I overburden myself with the creatine phosphate powder, and that gets metabolized into creatinine, and that gets sent to my kidneys, if I overstuff and overwork my kidneys with it, might I have a possibility of damaging my kidneys? And sure enough, if you Google the creatine supplements and kidney failure, you'll get 2 million hits. It was bound to happen. So I had to stop my bodybuilding career. I want to talk about something else that's clinically significant that you should know for this course. You will see measured 1,000 times a day in the hospital on your patients something called the BUN and the CR. Some people just call that the BUN. It stands for the blood urea nitrogen, and the CR stands for the creatinine. They are commonly measured day in and day out to assess kidney function. Because if my kidneys start to lose function, then I cannot excrete the urea and the creatinine in my urine. Therefore, it builds up in my blood. The higher the blood urea nitrogen is and the higher the creatinine is in my blood, that's a fairly decent indication that my kidneys aren't working as well as they should be. So yes, this is real life stuff, and yes, I want you to know what I just said. Let's go ahead and move on to bilirubin. Bilirubin, you may remember from your studies of the liver, is a waste product. It's a waste product from the breakdown of red blood cells. Specifically, you should write down from the breakdown of hemoglobin. And bilirubin is toxic. It can cause jaundice. It can even be deadly. I believe I gave an example in the digestive unit of babies that can actually die from a disease called Kernicterus, from too much bilirubin inside their body. And sometimes the liver has problems. If the liver can't put the bilirubin in the bile, and if you can't get the bilirubin out through the bowel movements, then the kidneys try to take over. And you will see some patients, they have a darker colored urine from the pigment that's in the bilirubin. And you could diagnose sometimes liver disease by finding high bilirubin in the urine. The next chemical waste product in urine I want you to know about is called uric acid. Uric acid is a waste product from the breakdown of your old friends, nucleic acids. That should ring a bell. That includes things like DNA and RNA. That's right. When you break down DNA and RNA, one of the metabolites is uric acid, and you got to get rid of that from your body. You will see this in the real world. Some patients have high uric acid levels in their blood. And if they get too high, the uric acid tends to crystallize out in their joints and cause like a painful, swollen toe, for example. That disease, many of you may have heard of, it's called gout, G-O-U-T. Write it down. I think that's fair game for our course. You'll measure that in those patients. You will treat them with diet and medication and get their uric acid levels back to normal, and hopefully you'll treat their gout and get them feeling better. So yes, this is real life stuff. Last but not least, your kidneys are one of the main ways to get rid of drug metabolites and toxins out of your body. The liver was the other organ that helped to detoxify drugs and toxins. And please, never forget this. I'm going to tell you a true story. I knew an intern one time who was called in the middle of the night, 3 a.m. He was awoken from sleep by a nurse. The nurse called the intern and said, "Please, Dr. So-and-so, Mrs. Jones is being very belligerent, and I'm trying to have a break here. You know, it's the 11 to 7 shift, and after all, I figured I wasn't supposed to be doing a whole lot of work, but Mrs. Jones is keeping me awake. Could you please give her a sleeping pill so we can all get some rest around here?" So the intern, half asleep, just said, "Okay, fine, I'll call in a such and such of a sleeping pill." Well, about 3 hours later, the intern went on rounds and saw Mrs. Jones, and Mrs. Jones was asleep. She was really asleep. She was in a coma because the intern forgot to ask the question that you need to ask in every patient. Before you give any drug to every patient, you better, of course, ask, number one, are they allergic to it? Number two, you better know the patient's liver status and their kidney status, because the only way that drugs can get detoxified, metabolized, and out of the body are through a combination of the liver and or the kidneys. Well, it turns out that the patient that I'm talking about here had both liver failure and kidney failure, so they quickly became toxic, if you will, from the sleeping pill, and they went into a coma. Thankfully for that intern, that patient woke up and was okay. But never forget that story, and I hope none of you ever make such a mistake. Let's talk about the third bullet point on this slide, and we've already discussed this during the fluid balance and electrolyte part of this course. One of the big jobs of the kidneys is to regulate blood ionic composition. For example, by regulating how much sodium, potassium, calcium, chloride, phosphate, you name it, by regulating how much of that stuff we pee out, I mean, that regulates how much we keep in. So, yes, that is a key function of the kidneys. On this next slide, we see another really big function of the kidneys. Please remember, your body cells are making acid all day, every day. If you don't get rid of it, you don't make it to the next day. And one of the major functions of the kidneys is to regulate blood pH. We'll talk in the next section exactly how your kidneys regulate blood pH. But I'd like to say here, kind of for fun, but also to kind of help you remember this, how do your kidneys regulate blood pH? With a little bit of P and a little bit of H. Because if you remember, H stands for hydrogen ions, and hydrogen ions represent acids. And our kidneys do pee out the H. They pee out the acid. More detail on that later. The kidneys also regulate blood osmolarity. That is, they regulate water and solute balance in our body. It boils down to the same general simple principle. If my kidneys regulate how much salt water goes out of me, they therefore regulate how much salt water stays in me, which leads to the next point. That regulates how much volume I have in my blood vessels. And if I regulate how much blood volume I have, I regulate, of course, how much blood pressure I have. It's all tied together. The last thing on this slide is something new to you. The kidneys, of course, you knew, filtered your blood and made urine and got rid of waste products probably before you even took this course. But I bet you didn't know that the kidneys were actually part of the endocrine system. That's right. They produce two very important hormones. The hormones are erythropoietin and calcitriol. What does erythropoietin do? Boy, that's a mouthful. By the way, all my friends, when we're out on the weekends drinking soda, we just all call it EPO, E-P-O for short. Erythropoietin stimulates the production of red blood cells. You might remember that from earlier studies in A&P. And I like the name. Erythro refers to our red blood cells, our erythrocytes. So erythropoietin just means produce red blood cells. Now, some people use that in a fashion that is not appropriate. Recently in the news, at the time of this taping, there was a very famous athlete, not going to mention his name, but he was accused of blood doping. There's all different ways to blood dope. One way to blood dope is to inject yourself with artificial erythropoietin. It's called EPO-A, I believe. And if you shoot yourself up with EPO, of course, that stimulates red blood cell production. The more red blood cells you have, the higher oxygen carrying capacity you have to your tissues, the better your endurance, and so on. So athletes perform better with this blood doping, which, of course, is illegal. Very hard to detect because our body normally makes EPO, so it's hard to tell if someone's actually blood doping. We can also use this for good. As a matter of fact, you will see patients who have low red blood cell counts, maybe from bone marrow diseases, maybe from drug side effects, maybe from HIV, and you will help patients by injecting them with EPO. So mark my words, many of you who go into healthcare, you will inject EPO into patients to boost their red blood cell count. The second hormone on this list is calcitriol. Believe it or not, calcitriol is actually a vitamin that's classified as a hormone. Calcitriol is the most active form of vitamin D. There's a pathway of vitamin D processing. When we drink vitamin D, in milk, it first goes to the liver for processing, then it's finally sent to the kidneys where it reaches its most active form. Vitamin D may also start in the skin. It then sends its chemical precursor to the kidneys, which once again sends it finally to the liver. Finally to the kidneys, where we produce the most active form of vitamin D, as in David, called calcitriol. And what do we need vitamin D for? Why do they put vitamin D in milk? It's so you can actually absorb the calcium and phosphorus that's in the milk so you can get it to your bones and to your teeth when you need it. Okay, so you're thinking, so what? I'm big bad A and P2. I can remember that the kidneys make two hormones. I can remember their two functions. But who cares? Let me give you some clinical implications of this. And oh yeah, it's fair for the test, of course. What two common conditions will almost every chronic renal failure patient have based on your knowledge of what I just told you? Think about it. On the test, you will pick out that they will all have anemia. That's a low red blood cell count, and they will all have bad bones. The technical name is renal osteoporosis. So write down anemia and osteoporosis. And if you do rotate through the kidney unit, you will see when you measure the blood count on the kidney failure patients, their hemoglobin and hematocrit will be around 9 and 27. That's kind of where they live, right in that range, because they have low erythropoietin levels in their blood. You and I, if I measured a hemoglobin and hematocrit, would be more around 15 and 45, for an example. And yes, they will all have bad bones. They will all have osteoporosis as well. And now you know why. Because if you damage the kidneys, you can't make these hormones, and that leads to those two common conditions. Now some easy stuff. The kidneys, here they are, some basic gross anatomy. They are paired organs. They are shaped like kidney beans. No, I don't know what came first, a kidney bean or the kidney. As far as the measurements here, I'm not big on numbers. Don't memorize these numbers. Your kidneys are about the size of your fist. Here's a beautiful gross anatomy picture. I just love looking at gross anatomy. So here's a human kidney. There's the adrenal gland right on top of it. So just kind of cool to look at a real human kidney with the artery and the vein and the ureter all coming out of it. So you can marvel at that at home at your leisure. This slide's very important. If you're going into x-ray, if you're going into ultrasound, if you're going to be doing biopsies on someone's kidneys, well, you better know where they are. They are located just above the waist, about between the levels of vertebrae T12 through L3. Notice they are between the peritoneum and the very back wall of the abdomen. If you've seen them in the kitty cat, I mean, they are plastered smack against the back of the body cavity wall. They are actually behind the parietal peritoneum, and there's a name for that. It's called, or they are called, retro, R-E-T-R-O, peritoneal. That means behind. If any of you ever seen me, I always give the funny example in my class, kind of like my haircut is retro. It's behind. Yeah, it's still like 70s kind of a haircut. So retroperitoneal means behind the peritoneum. They are protected partially by our last two ribs, the 11th and 12th rib. And remember, the right kidney is lower than the left kidney because it is pushed down by the big right lobe of the liver. So once again, if you ultrasound someone and the right kidney is a little bit lower, don't tell them it's falling out of their body. It's probably not. It's probably just normal for them. This next picture I love. It's a picture to describe some of the external anatomy of the kidneys. We'll describe the position and the coverings of the kidneys. But what I want you to take out of this picture as well is something clinically relevant. Look at the transverse plane where they got this from and slapped it on this slide. This view where the patient is laying on their back, here's the back and here's anterior. is the same view that you will see CAT scans and MRI scans displayed in view boxes. Did you ever see a doctor flip up a scan in a view box, either on a TV show or in a real hospital? Well, this is how they flip them up. It is as if you are looking up into the patient through their feet. So the head, their head is like behind the screen that you're looking at now. That's why when you look at an MRI scan, a CAT scan, or this picture, check it out. This is the right kidney. This is the big right lobe of the liver. This is the left kidney. It's as if you're looking up through the body, through their feet as they're laying down. So hopefully that's a little tidbit that will help you in the hospitals. So let's check this picture out. The kidneys are sitting right about where they're supposed to be. Check it out. There's the body of lumbar vertebrae number 2. Some basic anatomy of many organs shown on this side. There is a dimple or a little divot in this kidney. That is called the renal hilum. That is where vessels, nerves, and in this case a ureter emerge from the hilum of the kidney. We've seen a hilum before in the lungs. We've seen it in a lymph node, a spleen. We'll see it again in an ovary. It's anatomy 101. Then let's check out the kidney itself and its protective coverings. Number 1, plastered right on the kidney, shown here as a thin white line. This is a connective tissue smooth covering on the kidney. It kind of looks like shrink wrap or cellophane. It gives shape to the kidney. That's why, you know, you could pick up a kidney and, you know, throw it across the room like a football if you wanted to. Now, don't do that. You'll get fired right away. But that's what gives the shape to the kidney. Just outside of that, we have the middle layer. That is adipose or fat tissue. Let's stop right there. What's the purpose of fat tissue there? Remember, form and function match. The purpose of that fat capsule is protection. So if someone's walking out behind La Vila and gets sucker punched in the back, he may not get a kidney contusion necessarily, because not only might his ribs protect him, but the fat capsule, the adipose tissue, might also protect him. By the way, I heard that story all the time when I was working in the ER. Someone says, oh, I was out behind, you know, Spinnaker, minding my own business, and some guy just jumped me. And I got called in the middle of the night to see that, and then the police came in, and of course the story was always the same. He wasn't minding his own business. He was usually messing around with someone's girlfriend or something. But you'll see that guaranteed here in Bay County, 3 a.m. On the weekend. But anyway, the fat capsule's there to protect you. Next layer of this little sandwich that we're making here is this what we call renal fascia. It is just another thin layer of connective tissue, and it does hold the kidneys against the back body wall. I've done a little animation on this PowerPoint if it helps you at home. Number 1, we have the renal hilum there shown with a red box. Number 2, we show the renal capsule followed by the adipose tissue followed by the renal fascia. I just make myself a fat sandwich around the kidney. The capsule is the first layer of bread. Then we got fat in the middle. So thank goodness I'm making a fat sandwich. And then the renal fascia is the outer layer of white bread. So make yourself a fat sandwich if it helps you remember the layers. Another thing this reminds me of on the slide, if someone has a kidney stone or a kidney infection or something like that, guess where they're going to have the pain? And you already know the answer, I bet. They're going to have pain in their back. It makes sense if you understand this picture. It makes sense if you understand what you saw in the kitty cat in the lab. This picture here is mostly for you. This is a sagittal section through the kidney showing the right kidney and those protective coverings. I just want to mention something in case you think you'll never see this again. In elderly patients, especially thin elderly women, what tends to happen with time, with gravity, is those protective coverings I just talked about, they tend to get loose and disintegrate and degenerate with time. And the kidney actually can drop. Now, it's not going to drop out of the body and fall on the floor, but it can drop enough where it can twist and it can kink. If you kink, for example, the ureter, That's a no different of a sensation than having a kidney stone lodged in the ureter. If I kink or clamp a ureter, it hurts. And in older patients where the kidney drops and kinks the ureter, they have severe sudden onset back pain. They get rushed into the ER. You run through your list of possibilities. You find on the scan that they do have a dropped kidney. The name for it, by the way, just for fun, is nephrotosis. And you'll go in there, you'll do surgery, and you just tack that puppy back up, and they're good to go. So yeah, it's real life stuff. A little bit of internal anatomy, and again, this is anatomy 101. This outer light meat of the kidney, that is called the renal cortex. The inner darker meat, where you see these dark pyramid-shaped structures, that's the renal medulla. Again, that's anatomy 101. You'll be dreaming about this stuff before long. A few more details we must know, however. These pyramid or cone-shaped structures within the medulla are called renal pyramids. It ain't rocket science. They're shaped like pyramids in 3D. Then the tip, the pointy part of the pyramid, has a name. It's called the renal papillae. Papillae in Greek just means nipple or bump-shaped. So that little nipple shape of the pyramid is called the renal papillae. And that's important because there is part of the ductwork of the kidney located in there, right here in yellow where I'm tracing this duct that's within the papillae of the pyramid. Some genius is going to call that the papillary duct, and that makes sense for my pea brain. Last on this slide, there are some projections of the pale cortex that sort of dive in between the pyramids. They are called renal columns because they're shaped like columns. And notice they are pieces of cortical tissue between the pyramids. Some more internal anatomy. If you follow the ureter backwards into the kidney and you sort of fan it out into this wide open basin, if you will, that expanded upper portion of the ureter inside the kidney has a name. It's called the renal pelvis. And pelvis in anatomy just means a basin. Here it's a basin for urine. There's a bony pelvis as well. In a woman, that's a basin for the baby, so to speak. If we continue following this structure backwards, we have these cup-like structures that are sort of cupping the papillae of the pyramids, and these cup-like structures are called renal calyces. In Greek, if you like your root words, calyx just means a cup. So it's kind of cool because we'll see that the pyramids put the pea into the cup, and then from the cups we go to the basin. So I think it's kind of cool the way that someone named these hundreds of years ago. This is just a slide to show you the drawing and some corresponding human gross anatomy. So that's cool to look at the real deal, but there's nothing new on this slide. Finally, we're getting into the nitty-gritty. We're going to look at the internal anatomies of the kidneys, but we're going to go more microscopic now, guys. We're going to take a look at this thing here shown in yellow that I'm tracing. This is, if anybody asks you, the main functional unit inside the kidney, and it is called a nephron. Each kidney contains about a million nephrons. You're born with as many as you get, and you don't get any more. With age, they kind of wither on the vine, and nephrons are like neurons. Once they're whacked, they don't come back. What I did in this slide is something real special. I kind of manufactured this figure myself from other ones available from your book resources to try to help you understand this better, because I think the book really didn't have a good picture here, quite honestly. Here is a medium-sized power of the nephron. What I'm showing you here is a little wedge of the cortex and a pyramid out of the medulla. Here is, in yellow, the nephron. I'm going to suck that out, blow it up really big, and I slapped it over here on the right-hand side of the slide. This is the nephron. This is the main functional unit in the kidney. Let's break it down and look at it in detail. The nephron consists of the renal corpuscle, which is this ball-like structure, and this renal tubule, which is a tubular-like structure. I just say to myself, what is the nephron? The nephron is a ball and a tube. You can't just say the nephron is a ball and a tube. You got to use the technical names. When you looked at the slides in histology, check it out. I mean, all that's on that slide is balls and tubes. That's how I know a kidney is a kidney whenever anybody shows it to me on a slide. All a kidney is balls and tubes. So let's look at the nephron in detail. First, we'll look at the ball, then we'll look at the tube, and we'll see how they work. So let's start with the ball. The ball is really called the renal corpuscle. The renal corpuscle is the site where blood is going to get filtered. I think of these renal corpuscles as filtering balls. Again, you can't call this a filtering ball on the test, but that's a good kind of slang term to remember this thing. What does the filtering ball consist of? Two major parts. Number one, this wadded up ball of capillaries. It's kind of like a ball of yarn. That ball of capillaries, of course, has a name because we name everything in anatomy, and it's called the glomerulus. The glomerulus is the ball of capillaries. Then we have this capsule-like structure that surrounds the glomerulus, and some genius called that, you got it, the glomerular capsule. Everyone in the real world, though, by the way, including the kidney doctors, call the glomerular capsule Bowman's capsule. So I want you to know the synonyms. I'm not big on synonyms. I only use them when they're used commonly in the real world. So, yes, I want you to know it's usually called Bowman's capsule. Let's break this down in even more detail. So we're still talking about the ball now. We're still talking about the filtering ball called the renal corpuscle. I want you to look at the glomerulus, the ball of capillaries, in more detail. All the glomerulus is a ball-shaped network of capillaries where the filtration occurs. I just think of this like a ball of yarn. Sometimes I just wad my fingers up into a fist, and I think of my fist as this ball of capillaries called the glomerulus. But check this out. This is a really special, unique ball of capillaries because, look here, we have an afferent arteriole coming into the ball. Remember, A for afferent, A for approach. Then we wad up into the ball of capillaries. Then we have an efferent arteriole. Remember, efferent, E for exit. That's the exit arteriole leaving the ball of capillaries. Why am I so excited about this? Why do I have an exclamation point at the end of this sentence? Because this is very unique in the human body. I mean, think of any other capillary network you've ever studied. It's arteriole into the capillary network, and then what? Venule out of the capillary network. This is weird. We have arteriole in and arteriole out. That's kind of bizarre. It's kind of special. That's why I'm excited about it. And that's how you should remember it, by the way. Now we'll also look at the other part of the renal corpuscle called the glomerular capsule. In lab, I think we might have kind of lied to you a little bit. In lab, I think we told you this structure here that I'm tracing is the glomerular capsule. Well, that's only half true because the glomerular capsule is really a double-walled or a two-layered structure. Your book calls it a double-walled epithelial cup. Here's how I think of it. Take your fist. Imagine it's the glomerulus, the wad of capillaries. Then think of taking a balloon, a very limp balloon, and then shove your fist, shove those capillaries into the balloon. Won't that ball of capillaries then be covered by two layers of rubber? And they will. So shove your fist, not really, I'm just saying an example. Shove your fist into a balloon. It will have two layers on it. So let's look at the two layers that make up the capsule. The outer wall tracing has the same root word we've used many times in anatomy. It is the parietal layer. Remember, parietal means the outer wall or lining of something. It is formed by a layer of simple squamous epithelial cells. But then there's the inner wall. That's the layer of rubber that's plastered right on your fist, so to speak. The inner layer is called the visceral layer. Remember, viscera means guts. And I think of my fist of capillaries as the guts. So these are the guts. We got a visceral layer right on the guts. Those are simple squamous epithelial cells on top of those capillaries as well. But someone gave those, unfortunately, for our studying pleasure, a special name. They are called podocytes with a star. Remember, site means cell, podo means foot. So they're foot cells. And the way I remember it is I just picture my fist, and then I imagine teeny weeny little foot-shaped cells just walking all over my capillaries. And that's just one memorization. One memorization technique that I use for myself. Then there is a space. And this is a recurrent theme in anatomy. Whenever you've seen a parietal and visceral layer, whether it was around the heart, the lungs, or in the belly, there was always a space between them, wasn't there? And the space between them here is called the capsular space that everyone in the real world calls Bowman's space. Okay, so the nephron is the main functional unit in the kidney, right? And the nephron is the ball in the tube. We're done with the ball, now we're going to do the tube. That is really called the renal tubule. And the fluid that is filtered out of the filtering ball passes through the renal tubule. In order, the renal tubule consists of, first, here we go, coming right out the ball, the proximal convoluted tubule. That just means the near twisty tubule in Greek. I've highlighted it with a star on the animated PowerPoint. Next comes this hairpin loop kind of structure, and someone who discovered this, I guess they named it after themselves. It is called the loop of Henle, H-E-N-L-E. And the loop of Henle has a loop that goes down, and someone called that the descending limb of the loop of Henle. And it also has a loop that goes up, and someone called that the ascending limb of the loop of Henle. Finally, the last part of the renal tubule, the last part of the nephron, by definition, is this twisty tubule piece called the distal convoluted tubule. Distal just means far, because it's the furthest away. It's the far twisty tubule called the distal convoluted tubule. And if you're looking at this at home, the PowerPoint is animated, and I put little red stars up so you can remember this all in the proper order. Because this could be one of those put it in the right order kind of questions that we like in anatomy. I put a question at the bottom of the slide. Could you trace flow of fluid through a nephron? Of course you can. It's easy. Just follow this diagram. But even though we got fluid maybe to the end of the nephron, we certainly haven't gotten the fluid out of the kidney, and we certainly haven't gotten it out of the body either. So let's finish up the flow of fluid from the nephron through the kidney and out of the body. Let's do the total flow on this slide. So here's where we left off. Here's the distal convoluted tubule of the nephron. But we're not done yet. From there, the fluid is collected into a series of ducts called collecting ducts that I'm tracing in yellow. That duct just continues into another series of ducts, and it's really just a name change game here. When the duct in yellow gets in the papillae of the pyramid, we call it the papillary duct. Remember, then the pee from the pyramid dumps into the cups. The cups you will call the calyces. From the cups, we dump the urine into the basin that you know is called the renal pelvis. From there, it goes into the ureter, then the urinary bladder, and then finally through the urethra where it can get thrown out of the body, so to speak. So that's the total pathway of flow that you should know. Your book classifies nephrons into two major groups, so I'll do it here. It's fairly straightforward. Let me orient you first on the diagram. Here are two wedges of kidney meat. The top light meat is renal cortex. The bottom dark meat is the medulla. Specifically, it's where the pyramids are. There's a dashed line that separates those two layers. And then we have our nephron, right? Our ball and our tube. Our ball and our tube. On the left, we see the ball and the tube are mostly in the cortex. So some genius said, I will call those cortical nephrons because they're mostly in the cortex. You should know that they form the majority of nephrons in the human body. About 80% of our nephrons are cortical nephrons. However, look over to your right here. Here we have the ball. Notice the ball, the renal corpuscle, is always in the cortex. But in this next kind of a nephron, the tube dives way down deeper into the medulla. And since it does that, someone said, I will call these juxtamedullary nephrons because they dive deep in the medulla. Even though only about 20% of all our nephrons are juxtamedullary nephrons, they do most of the work. They have the power. They have the better ability to adjust the concentration of urine. So if I ask you which one we have the most of, you say cortical. If I say which one is the most powerful one, you say the juxtamedullary nephrons. This slide is a key slide. I'm going to say this probably at least two more times in this course. If you do not know the blood supply to an organ, you do not know how it works. You must know the blood supply of the kidneys. Off to your right, anybody could read this list off to you just as well as I can, and I'm not going to read it off to you. That would be boring. I want to cut to the chase, and I want to tell you what I know is important for my course, because I know what's important clinically, and also I make my tests. So here, look, here's the summary. Renal artery goes into the kidney, renal vein goes out of the kidney. Okay, that's anatomy 101. But what do you have to know stone cold? I put a black box around it. You must know this blood supply in here because this is the blood supply to the nephron. This is the blood supply to the main functional unit of the kidney. So I'm going to take out the nephron and its blood supply, and I'm going to blow it up on the next slide really big, and we're going to know this stone cold. So here it goes. It's easy. Half of it's actually old. What is the blood supply of the nephron? Afferent arteriole brings the blood in to the wad of capillaries called the glomerulus. Efferent arteriole exits the ball. And then the new stuff is, what I didn't tell you that yet, is that there are some capillaries that branch off the efferent arterioles. You need to know them. The ones that go around the tubules, some rocket scientists call the peritubular capillaries. Peri means around, so these are the around the tubular capillaries. Then there's also some capillaries that go straight up and down the loop of Henle. Those are called the vasa recta with a star. Vasa just means vessel. Recta just means straight. The vasa recta goes straight up and down the loop of Henle. Let's stop here for a minute because you're thinking, okay, I'm big bad A&P. I can memorize this stuff. It's not that hard. But guys, step back and look at the big picture because that's how you learn things better. This is where we're going to have the exchange of the good and the bad. You knew already the kidneys are the big place where it's kind of in with the good, out with the bad. This is where all the magic happens. Form and function match. The design matches the mission. Look how we have intimately applied a perfectly matching shape of capillaries that are hooked up with the nephron. Because this is where we are going to have the exchange of the good stuff and the bad stuff. Where hopefully we'll have the good stuff stay in the blood where we need it, and the bad stuff's going to go out the yellow tubes, you know, in your urine. So that's the beauty of understanding this anatomy in detail and how closely it all matches. A beautiful design. We'll get into the details of how it works, starting with this slide. I'm going to end this section with this slide. Let's put some of this together. There's a very special part of the nephron you must know. It is called the juxtaglomerular apparatus. All my friends on the weekends, when we're out having fun, we call it the JGA. Because if you say juxtaglomerular apparatus, I drink your beverage, your soda, of course, right in front of you, I kick you out of the group. So the JGA, what is it, where is it, and how does it work? First of all, it is located where the afferent arteriole meets the ascending limb of the loop of Henle. Of course you got to know that. Sometimes I say to myself for fun as a memorization technique, I call it the JGAAA. Those two extra A's remind me of what makes up the JGA. It's the afferent arteriole with an A and the ascending limb of the loop of Henle with an A. So that's a good memorization technique. Then what you have to know is, in arterioles, of course, you have smooth muscle cells in the walls. You learn that in vascular A and P. But these cells in the walls of the afferent arteriole are very special smooth muscle cells. They have a special name. They're called juxtaglomerular cells. They are modified special smooth muscle cells in the wall of the afferent arteriole. And what you must write down here is they have the special ability to sense stretch. Why? Because that gives them the ability, gives your kidneys the ability to help regulate blood pressure. Many of you may have known that before you heard this today, that the kidneys are the main part of your body that help regulate blood pressure. And that is absolutely correct. They help regulate blood pressure through something called, wait for it, the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. A lot of people just call it the RAS system, R-A-A-S for short. Let's talk about how it works. You have to know this stone cold, and I'll do it by example. No better way than by example. Let's say you have a patient is bleeding out, or maybe they're severely dehydrated. What's going to happen here? This afferent arteriole, is it going to be all swollen, chock full, and puffed and stretched out with blood? No, because they're dehydrated or maybe dying because they're bleeding out. So in this case, the afferent arteriole is all shriveled up. And when JG cells, juxtaglomerular cells, are less stretched, when they are shriveled, they say, oh boy, I must be low a few quarts on volume and on blood pressure, so I'm going to do something to try to save myself. And the JG cells, they release an enzyme, a chemical called renin. When renin goes up in the human body, a series of chemical reactions take place that I'm going to cut to the chase on. And after the reactions take place, another chemical in the body, a hormone called angiotensin, also goes up. And I love the word angiotensin. What does it sound like? Angio refers to your blood vessels, to your arteries. And tensin sounds like it's going to tense. And angiotensin is a hormone that once it's produced, it starts to cause all your blood vessels to clamp down. And that's going to give you, hopefully, an increase in your blood pressure. Angiotensin, through a series of chemical reactions, leads to production of another hormone we know called aldosterone. And aldosterone, if you remember, is the pump up the volume chemical. It was the add salt water chemical. So when aldosterone goes up, it adds volume, salt water volume to your blood vessels. That also leads to an increase in blood pressure. So Here's the story. When JG cells shrivel, when they are less stretched, renin goes up, angiotensin goes up, aldosterone goes up, and blood pressure goes up. Write it down. And a little memorization technique here. They always go in the same order for my course. I'll give you the opposite example. Let's say Mr. Jones was fluid overloaded because you gave him 27 bags of IV fluid in 2 hours. In this case, what's the deal? Well, the afferent arteriole is about ready to pop. The JG cells, of course, are overstretched. And when they're overstretched, they say, oh, boy, we're almost about to pop here. So we don't want to, you know, burst a brain aneurysm either. So I will decrease renin. So renin goes down. Then you guessed it, angiotensin goes down. Then aldosterone goes down. Then hopefully blood pressure goes down, all in the same direction. So hopefully by those two examples, you'll never forget how your kidneys, how the JGA regulates your blood pressure. I'll give you another example, a clinical example of what you'll see in the real world. Someone who knew this, who was very smart, says, well, if that's how your body regulates blood pressure, I will help fix high blood pressure patients. And you will see many of the drugs that you will give to patients, they will block the system. Some drugs you will give are called ACE inhibitors. That stands for angiotensin converting enzyme inhibitor. In other words, they knock down angiotensin to knock down blood pressure. Other drugs like spironolactone, or I think it's called aldactone, I think they knock down aldosterone. And if you block aldosterone, you knock back that part of the system and you knock back the blood pressure. So what I'm saying is someone who knew this made blood pressure drugs that knock these chemicals down. You knock them down, you knock blood pressure down. Don't quote me on those chemical names, by the way. I'm getting a little rusty on that, forgetting some of those drug names. I do want to tell you one last story before I end this unit. It's a story about a friend of mine. She was a young lady in her 20s. It didn't happen around here, so don't go trying to figure out who it was. But she went to the doctor one day, and her blood pressure was 220 over 120. And the doctor was rushing through the clinic that day, you know, trying to make extra Porsche payments, I guess. So he said, okay, here's a blood pressure pill. Take this pill and come back and see me in 2 months. What's wrong with that picture? A lot is wrong with that picture. A young lady should never have a blood pressure 220 over 120. That makes no sense. All sorts of red flags should be going up. Plus, you don't just put someone on a pill and say, come back in 2 months with that kind of blood pressure. But she did, and she came back in 2 months, and her blood pressure was 210 over 110. And he said, well, take another pill and come back and see me in 2 months. And, of course, that sounds all wrong, I hope, to you as well. So she takes another pill, comes back in 2 months. Her blood pressure is 200 over 100. And he says, well, let's add a third pill. He adds a third pill, says, come back in 2 months. And at this point in time, all sort of red flags should be going off. I mean, a young woman, blood pressure through the roof, unresponsive to multiple medications, all kind of red flags should be going off in your brain. And finally, she goes back for a fourth visit and says, oh, blood pressure is still 200 over 100. Maybe I should think back to when I went to medical school and what I was actually trained to do. And he said, I kind of seem to remember the kidneys have something to do with blood pressure. I think I'm going to get a special scan of your kidneys after all that time. And after all the expense, all the cost of the drugs, all the side effects of the drugs, my friend's hair was falling out of her head as a side effect of the drugs. Of course, she might have been getting damage to her organs from high blood pressure. Finally, he does a study and determines that she has a condition that I would like you to search on the internet called renal artery stenosis. It tends to occur in younger women. We don't know why it happens, but the walls of the renal artery just tend to thicken. It's sort of like crimping a hose. If I took a pair of vice grip pliers and I crimped the renal artery to my right kidney, the right kidney would not receive proper blood volume or proper blood pressure. So what was happening in that friend of mine and in these patients is the kidney thinks it's not getting enough blood pressure. So the kidney does exactly what it was designed to do. It puts out a whole bunch of renin, then angiotensin goes up, then aldosterone goes up, then blood pressure goes up. That doctor could have dumped drugs into my friend until the cows came home, and her blood pressure would have still been through the roof. It maybe sounds like my blood pressure is getting up, but I didn't find out about all this until she told me, you know, months later. But in any case, so finally he made the diagnosis, and there's a couple ways to treat renal artery stenosis. You could take out the narrowed section and sew the two good ends together, or you could put a stent in to open it up. But in either case, you fix the issue. Because, again, the kidney was getting faked out. The kidney thought the blood pressure was low when it really wasn't. Again, this all boils down to knowledge of this anatomy and physiology. So, yes, it's real-life stuff that you will see in healthcare in the future.